What's up, world? I'm Matt Newberg from Hungry, and this is The Feed. Each episode, we'll dive into conversations with the industry insiders who are leveraging technology to shape the way we eat. On today's episode of The Feed, the Hungry Trends community sat down with Barnaby Montgomery, co-founder and CEO of Yummy.com, one of the first online grocers to deliver in 30 minutes or less since 2002. We chat about everything from unit economics of new quick commerce players to inventory selection and the trade-offs between full-time drivers and gig workers. I'm very excited to be here today with one of the OGs in the quick commerce space, Barnaby Montgomery. Barnaby is the CEO and co-founder of Yummy.com, a vertically integrated grocer that has been delivering across LA in 30 minutes since 2002. A few years ago, Barnaby also purchased the defunct brand Cosmo.com to form what is now a dark store warehouse in the San Fernando Valley. So I feel like there's so much here to talk about. I want to go back to just after the dot-com bubble to 2002. Tell us how you started Yummy.com with $100,000 and not $100 million and what the landscape was like back then.
Yeah, you know, the genesis of the business was really in the cell phone business where, you know, I had attempted to start a company called NewCellPhone.com where we would deliver cell phones in about an hour because going to Best Buy sucks. Right. I went to Best Buy and needed a cell phone. It took an hour for me round trip to get my phone out the door. And, you know, it was annoying. Because that failed, I wound up getting a job at a company that was attempting to deliver groceries on behalf of Stater Brothers Markets as an outsourced fulfillment provider, really Instacart 1.0. So we delivered groceries on a next day basis by appointment, you know, in a scheduled 1 hour window. And there was obviously no demand for that service, right? Nobody wants to schedule their order and wait around at home for their food. So really, my co-founder and I were working at that company together, commuting together, and in the car, we developed Yummy.com, where we put together the immediate fulfillment of a full assortment of groceries in about 30 minutes.
So what did your proof of concept look like? Walk us through how you went about validating that idea and vertically integrating.
Well, we've never raised any capital, which is really an important data point to understand why the business looks the way it does. You know, we capitalized it with money out of our pocket, an initial investment of about $100,000, with which we bought a failed liquor store in Hollywood because it was entitled. Right, it was fully permitted for the sale of groceries, beer, wine, and liquor. So we didn't have to ask permission to operate the business or develop the business. And it was failed, so we didn't need to seek capital from anybody else. And it was a failed location because it was inconvenient and nobody would walk in. So for many years, it functioned as a dark store, right? It was technically open to the public, but nobody cared. Nobody walked in. It was a meaningless retail environment. But we hit the ground running and, you know, we grew the business from there. The initial assortment was, you know, about 1,000 SKUs, very limited fresh offer, beer, wine, and liquor, and a small deli operation we installed in the back. You know, we delivered in about 30 minutes, which was always our vision to deliver faster than a trip to the store. For us, the business must be faster than you. Right? Faster than you can do the job yourself, whatever the job is. Otherwise, there's no point in your order, right? Unless you need a delivery, right? And very few people need a delivery. We all needed a delivery last year, but absent COVID, you basically don't need a delivery. It has to be better than you can do the job yourself to induce mass market demand.
Can you walk me through that moment where you're with your co-founder, you're working at this Instacart 1.0 company, and it's just not working out. The market's not ready. What was the thought that basically led you to say, we can't do this next day fulfillment on top of another store? What brought you to that conclusion that the best idea was to go out and buy that liquor retailer?
Well, it's just vision, right? That you know, if you're in my seat and my co-founder's seat, right, you have visions that appear in your head. And as a founder of a business, right, you see where you're going and you execute upon that path. The fear to begin, once surmounted, right, was the biggest obstacle. because we kind of knew what we were going to do, what we were going to try and do. So there was a light bulb moment built upon actual knowledge of what works and what did not work. And, you know, we were iterating based upon, you know, prior work.
So you buy this liquor store. Talk us through what else you had to get off the ground in addition to that. You had to go inventory everything, come up with your pricing, go to market strategy, last mile logistics. What were some of those key early decisions you made in those days?
So, you know, the primary analogy to an on-demand service is a pizza delivery. I think, you know, you're ultimately not delivering groceries, but instead you're delivering a basket of gross profit, less costs with something left over. So in spirit, if Domino's can deliver a $10 pizza profitably, you can deliver anything with the same amount of gross profit profitably if you can engineer your systems to, you know, deliver the assortment you want to offer. You know, our go-to-market was based on the need that what we wanted at home personally was groceries and food, right? We didn't want a convenience store assortment, right? I think you look at a lot of people playing in the space right now, and they're offering a convenience store assortment of what might be called daily essentials, right? And or products for immediate consumption. And we sought to offer a wider assortment of products that would satisfy a more mass market and perhaps a more rational customer, somebody who needed to buy not a 24 count of aspirin, but, you know, when you buy aspirin, you know, you go and you buy the proper package. In terms of the system development, that was one of the hardest parts for us because there is none today as well. But back then there was really no systems you could buy or rent. So everything was ground up. Everything. We've got our first developer off Craigslist. He came in. He's a great guy. And we interviewed him and we said, you know, there's a seat in the back storeroom. You know, you can start right now. And, you know, he sat down and began work. There's really nothing to test, nothing to lose. So he started work and we developed the basic system, which in principle operates today. Because it was a failed liquor store and was open to the public, that incremental sale at the register was a valuable component of the economic picture. You know, even $500 a day at the register, you know, spread out over 30 days, multiplied by 30 days, you know, had some contribution to the overhead. When we realized that, we said, you know, that's probably an important component of our go-to-market future strategy, our future go-to-market strategy. You know, those are kind of my thoughts on your question.
So I absolutely love what you're saying about the idea that you're not delivering groceries, you're delivering a basket of gross profit. That's such a great line. Obviously, the SKU selection of a defunct liquor store really doesn't resemble Yummy's current offering of fresh food and whatnot. So how much work did you do to start to rethink the SKU selection of that store? And how big of a role did alcohol play in that selection ultimately?
Yeah, you know, curation is a really important component of our success. And, you know, what products are you going to offer and where are you going to offer it? That's foundational to the business. The first year of operation, we were completely on the telephone as we developed our systems. And if a customer called and said, do you have, you know, insert name of product, what was the answer?
Yes.
Yes.
We'll go and grab it from anywhere.
I'm going to go to Ralph's and pick it up, right? Yeah. So now you have a new item to sell, right? And so initially our assortment was as wide as Ralph's because, you know, that's where we got the product.
It's amazing.
You know, demand induced the initial assortment. Curation followed as we began to understand the customers. And Ultimately, we looked within ourselves and said, what do we want? You know, at some level, we are the avatars for the business. I think whenever you are in our shoes or, you know, analogous business or something, if you don't have some idea yourself, you're not going to succeed. So, you know, I have this friend of mine who told me that, you know, he really wanted to open a restaurant. I said, oh, that's fantastic. You know, what ideas do you have? And he said, well, I don't have any. Well, you're not going to open a restaurant, right? You know, if you don't have any ideas and you can't curate this vision in a way that makes it marketable, you know, it's not going to move forward. And so I think a lot of this comes from within and obviously is directed by the customers.
So you were taking orders over the phone. You had your developer from Craigslist. What were the delivery times you were able to offer? What did people expect? And were they paying the same prices as the grocery store, or was there a premium?
Our prices have always been marked to the regular price at the conventional supermarket. So that anchor serves as our price today, as well as back then. In terms of the service offer, it was always 30 minutes. And initially, it was lightning fast. I mean, it was 15 minutes. It was 10 minutes. And that was because when you don't have any volume, right, you can deliver immediately because you have a driver standing around doing nothing. And so when you have a driver who is not actually completing deliveries, but is instead, you know, standing, waiting for an order, those orders can be accomplished very quickly. And the initial months, you know, as you ramp up, it takes months, a year, who knows, maybe longer now, to grow a business. And initially, service is so good because there's insufficient demand to keep the drivers moving.
And so what was the delivery fee for those customers? What were they paying on top? You know, so they weren't paying any premium, any markup on the actual goods, but what was the fee for the delivery?
It was probably $2.99.
Oh, wow.
I'm guessing. I don't remember. $3.99. You know, we always had a delivery fee, and we do today. You know, we create friction in the offer. You know, obviously, if we eliminate service fees and offer best in market pricing and deliver, you know, within 10 minutes, there's more demand there. But because we were not capitalized with any money, but, you know, rather just knowledge, you know, we needed to generate some cash. And so we always had a delivery fee, and we never tried to deliver in 10 or 15 minutes. We only did that, you know, incidentally to the fact we didn't have any demand.
Got it. And what were people saying, like, when you were coming so fast? Like, was this something that they were just, like, getting hooked on? Or as a result of that, you know, the fact that you had this, like, supply of drivers ready there, you know, to take the order and deliver it so mm-hmm. quickly, like, was that an added bonus, or were people just loving it?
Yeah, it was amazing, right? People loved it. The truth is that my first customer was a woman named Gloria Johnson, who was a wonderful woman. She died 7 or 8 years ago. We remained friends for many years. And I made that delivery. And I, you know, the first order, you're going to do it yourself. You know, nobody is going to touch that order. I'm going to do that order. So I did that order, and I get to her apartment, open the door. Here's this 5'2" woman, frail, not mobile. And I realized that, you know, this lady needs a delivery, right? Mm. And that was a problem because she was not my core customer, right? I wasn't setting out to deliver to customers who needed help, right? You know, people who need help and they need a delivery, they don't need it in 30 minutes. They don't want it in 30 minutes. They're just grateful for help. And when I made that delivery, I said to myself, this is great to have a customer, but I hope there are people who don't need me like Mrs. Johnson does. Mm. I think that's an important insight into the business. You know, mass market customers do not need a delivery. They don't need this. There is a supermarket on every corner and they do a great job. But, you know, prices are fair or cheap or expensive. You know, they're diverse. Whatever you want, go get it. And the spaces are quite nice, right? I love my local Trader Joe's. I'm a Costco shopper too, right? And mass market customers don't need a delivery. They don't live in a food desert. And to appeal to them, you're going to need something else.
So for that, what was that something else, would you say, for Yummy?
Well, it was the fact that we're faster than you, right? We are faster and more convenient than a trip to the store. And fast is not a function of urgency at home, right? It's not because you're in a rush, right? Mass market customers don't really have oops moments at home, like where you're cooking and you say, oops, I ran out of, you know, salad oil, you know, and I need it now. You know, people don't really have those urgent oops rush moments. Instead, it's just convenient. Right. It's just base level of convenience that, you know, this is a better life. You know, I can order, I can move on to what I I like doing or want to be doing or need to be doing. So, for example, even if you're going to pay $3 or $4 or $10 for a delivery, you know, if you look at it in relation to your own personal economics, you could rationally say you should be ordering delivery all the time because you could be making more money by working or by enjoying, you know. So that's really our approach to the business, not an oops moment or I'm in a rush or I'm in a panic at home.
This is much to the chagrin of, I think, of Gorillas and Joker and the newer services we'll talk about later. But I feel like they're really kind of selling that kind of use case heavily as a prime, you know, use case here as far as why they should be, why customers should be using it. But I think this also segues really nicely into what I really want to dive into here, which is kind of how you built retail in tandem. And when I think of yummy.com, I think about, you know, those two locations I've been to, one in Silver Lake and one in West Hollywood on Santa Monica Boulevard. You know, how did you go about selecting those sites or the expanding from this existing liquor retailer that you bought to these beautiful stores that people can now come in and shop, and you have this kind of flywheel going between some of that behavior we talked about around, you know, your local grocery shop that you're not saving the time, but then you have that ability to order 30 minutes. But how did you go about kind of building that retail strategy from there?
Well, I think the first part of the answer comes from feelings, right? Because I delivered to Mrs. Johnson, right, our first customer, you know, I realized the power of community, right? She became part of our community and the connection she had with us was real because she needed us. You know, a storefront in your neighborhood is really similar in that it's an extension of the business to the community, right? You're holding out your hand to the people in your community saying, you know, I can help you out in a couple of different ways. You know, you can come in if it's good for you or you can get a delivery. So it's really a function of reflecting the customers by being part of their community in a real intangible way on the corner in their neighborhood. The second part of the answer is that it provides, you know, leverage on the fixed costs of the operation. So even if you primarily view yourself as an online retailer, any dollar you sell at the cash register provides a little bit of leverage on the fixed cost. You know, in my experience, when you are, and I'm testing this at Cosmo, but when you operate a dark store that's anonymous and not part of the community, you clearly save on your overhead expense. However, a lot of that savings is going to be directed online to advertising and marketing your service to people who don't otherwise have any other way to get to know you.
Absolutely.
So there's ultimately no free lunch in life, right? And the locations in as they're scaled at yummy.com in terms of the footprint of the space, about 5,000 square feet, which would make them a small Trader Joe's, you know, an extremely large convenience store, not competitive in scale to a supermarket, you know, at 40 or 50,000 square feet, but sufficient to get, you know, anywhere between 3 and 5,000 SKUs into the community. You know, that's how the retail plays in our business at yummy.com.
So when you're going and figuring out, okay, let's build this model out. And right now you have about 5 retail locations throughout LA. You know, when I think about these delivery guys, you know, the newer quick commerce players, some of them are on the high street and other ones are maybe a little bit off the beaten path. Like you said, if you're doing a dark store, you're going to save money on the overhead. If it's you're taking over a cheap lease somewhere that's not subject to high foot traffic. But what were some of the qualities you were looking for as you were building this real estate strategy of where you were going to go and locate these stores? And then talk about maybe how you merchandise them inside. Are you thinking about the delivery, the driver or the shopper that's going to pick those orders? Are you thinking about the customer?
Right. You know, with regards to the other quick commerce players, there's no one way to skin the cat, right? All these guys are smart and everybody is going to find their own way. And there are clearly many ways to do this. I remember when we started, we owned another defunct brand called homegrocer.com. And somebody related to the team there called me up. And, you know, he was angry that we owned the brand at that time. Because, you know, this stuff is personal, right? It's like, you know, if somebody owned Yummy, I could imagine, you know, that would be annoying, right? But so, I mean, he was angry, viscerally angry. And, you know, I didn't have any money and newly established with an idea. And he was such a jerk. He was an absolute jerk to me, saying there's only one way to do this and you need me to do it. You know, if you're going to do this, you need me and what I know. And that is absolutely not true, because all these other quick commerce players, Amazon included, they're all brilliant in their own ways. And so there's nothing necessarily true about the way we do it. That's why, you know, with Cosmo, we're testing some things, because, you know, there's many ways to skin the cat.
Got it.
So, you know, with regards to the merchandising of the assortment within a Yummy, it is optimized primarily for picking. You know, we establish a route throughout the store that we think is best for the pick, and we accommodate the in-store shoppers to the best of our ability. I would, you know, most dark stores are going to sort their product on the shelf randomly. So on a particular 3 or 4 foot shelf, they're going to have candy bars next to cereal, next to shampoo on the same little shelf, because you can create density on the shelf in a way that allows you to have more SKUs within the footprint of the building. In our case, we don't do that. We always sorted the product on the shelf by category. So all the cereal is together. This distinction is important when you actually look into what a dark store operator is most likely to do, where it's going to be random assortment on a shelf designed to create density on the shelf. And because we were always committed to trying to be open to the public, you know, we never went down that road. I think that's an important distinction to mention in response to your question.
So because you were open to the public, you decided to optimize not for the density, you're saying. The density Correct. Is something that the dark store guys do. So you're more traditional.
We're open to the public.
Right, right. But so have you built your own inventory management system? Do you have the real-time inventory view into Yep. what's on the shelf, like to a high degree of precision?
It's always a mess because things are always being broken or lost or stolen. But we think we know what's on the shelf to the unit level for every SKU. So for, you know, a 12-pack of LaCroix, we think we know exactly how many instances of that, of a particular flavor we have, and we decrement based upon whatever we sell or receive. So, mm-hmm. you know, the inventory management system is just in time and perpetual, and it's accurate to the best of our ability, given the reality of an open-to-the-public retail space, right? If you have a dark store, mm-hmm. you'll have more control over the accuracy of that. But it is mm-hmm. distinguished from, you know, a conventional supermarket or drugstore, even, where they really have no idea what's on the shelf. And so right. we buy and replenish on the basis of actual movement, and mm-hmm. it's a just-in-time inventory system.
And is that something that you built yourself, or something you were able to find off the shelf from someone else?
No, totally customized. You know, the vision is really to have more than our fair share of the market, right? If you think about us as a retailer competing for grocery customers, we have no market share, right? Right. We start with zero. And so we're entitled to zero. And so without capital, we're trying to capture more than our fair share of the market. And so to do that, we're going to need to develop systems that are unique in the marketplace, that give us a competitive advantage over conventional retailers and our online or offline sophisticated competition. And so therefore, in answer to your question, our instinct is always to develop something that's proprietary and that we think provides us with a competitive advantage. Mm.
Love it. Very, very fascinating. And I saw this firsthand as an Instacart shopper myself, having seen how you know, the replacements work, and as a shopper, you know, going through the aisles, and you know, a lot of stuff is out of stock, and they have to basically use a lot of machine learning to predict what the demand is. So I see the huge amount of value in just-in-time inventory. Can you just like talk a little bit about, you know, an order comes in, how you're guaranteeing kind of that SLA around 30 minutes and the different roles and responsibilities of your staff? Do you have dedicated pickers, that sort of thing?
Yep. Now, we don't guarantee 30-minute deliveries. Instead, we deliver in about 30 minutes. You know, 90-something percent of orders are delivered in less than 30 minutes. But, you know, there's a reality that occurs at peak volume and at busy times in the day. So in terms of, you know, the traffic could be bad or the weather could be bad. So we don't actually guarantee a 30-minute delivery. But to accomplish it, we have a strict division of labor within the store. So when you're operating at high volume, the only way to process these orders is to have people who do specific jobs. Mm-hmm. So a picker picks, you know, a shopper shops. I mean, it's the same person, I'm sorry. So a picker or shopper, that's what they do. They don't also drive. A driver doesn't pick. And so there's a division of labor within the operation. The order is generated at the store. It immediately is available to the staff in a way that's similar to a restaurant. You know, when you're a server in a restaurant, you input your order into a system of some kind, and then it's transmitted into the kitchen. And when it's busy, they might get killed with receipts. You know, there's a tidal wave of orders that have moved into the kitchen. And our picking operation is similar in that when it's busy, it's actually more productive, because when it's busy, that's when you can move your body and you can accommodate the tidal force of the customer needs.
Are you doing batching?
No. Batch picking?
Well, batch picking and delivery, like are you sending out drivers with multiple orders, or is each driver going out with one?
So we do not batch pick. We think batch picking is slower, and we absolutely want to batch deliver, right? Mm-hmm. To the extent there are orders that can be routed together and that we can keep our promise, you definitely want to do that, because as we mentioned earlier, you know, you're delivering a basket of gross profit. And so if that driver is able to take more or larger orders, then that's a better economic outcome.
Yeah.
We deliver in about 30 minutes. So we're going to pick an order in about 10. And then we're going to have an additional 20 minutes to deliver that order to the customer and to keep our promise. So it's almost easy to deliver one order within 30 minutes. It's slightly harder to deliver two orders in 30 minutes, but it's really incredibly possible at volume when you have viable routes.
Mm-hmm.
In 30 minutes, it is very difficult to deliver three orders batched together within 30 minutes, right? Because you have a certain amount of drive time to the first delivery, and then, you know, you got to accomplish the delivery, and then you have to get to the second and the third. And it is fundamentally impossible to deliver four orders within 30 minutes of when they were placed. It's impossible.
Totally.
So that third and that fourth order will be greater than 30 minutes.
Right.
But you definitely want to batch to the extent you can.
I remember Cosmo.com from, I guess it was, must have been like 98, 99. I don't remember. I'm dating myself, but
you're an old man.
I was a kid and I ordered like, I don't know, Coca-Cola and I think like a Black Eyed Peas CD. Now it's like, okay, then Napster hit a year later and it's like, there's no reason to have a CD delivered.
Right.
But I remember it. And here we are, you know, 2021, we got all these other GoPuff, Gorilla's Joker, etc. You decide a couple years ago that you're going to go and buy this brand. What is it that drew you to Cosmo, and what are you looking to kind of do with that asset?
Well, you know, it's very hard to penetrate the marketplace with, you know, a name that anybody knows, right? To build a brand is very, very expensive and very difficult. And so, you know, to the extent you can get a little bit of a head start on that, I think it's a good thing. You know, we as part of our system, measure the customer acquisition cost and compare it to the lifetime value of the customer. And so for us, the analysis was that we think it might reduce our customer acquisition costs and have no impact on our lifetime value. So, you know, if that's $1 or $2 per customer, that's a good deal. You know, the idea at Cosmo is really to test, right? Now, I think I know a lot, but I'm not sure I know everything. And Cosmo offers, you know, a little wider assortment than yummy.com. And in both cases are much larger than the initial Cosmo assortment, right? So Cosmo went out to market with, you know, a really interesting and exciting offer, right? You can get anything delivered in 60 minutes. I think it was for free. I'm not sure. But, you know, you indulge them with an order, $15 CD and a $2 candy bar, you know, I don't know, $17. That probably worked back then. But to my recollection, there were a lot of like, it's not mercenary customer behavior, but it was opportunistic, you know, silly discovery orders. Like, will you really deliver me a pack of gum for free? And I just want one pint of ice cream. Can I have it? Sure. I'll send you, you know, a $3 pint of ice cream for free. So, you know, we changed a lot of that stuff, but, you know, it's really driven by the belief that there may be some knowledge of the brand in the ether and the deep recesses of your mind that might make it just a little bit easier to acquire you as a customer. Because Cosmo was always about the future, right? It's a futuristic name, right? Cosmo, cosmonaut, you know, it's about space and time and the future. You know, and that's really what we're about. And so I've always connected to that idea. And so, you know, I personally like it.
It definitely evokes a lot of nostalgia for me, a lot of 90s nostalgia, which I feel like everyone loves right now. And you said you're in the Valley, San Fernando Valley, doing a dark store. You know, if this test works out with the dark store, how do you envision that those learnings being applied to Yummy?
You know, I don't know if I'm not anticipating them being applied to Yummy. I really look at it as another avenue of exploration. You know, the ability to scale a dark store operation is much different than is that with a storefront open to the public on the corner of Main and Main in your neighborhood. It's just a different business. You know, there's economic outcomes that we're trying to discover as well. You know, to the extent that other operators know something that we don't, we're trying to reveal them to ourselves. So, you know, Jeff Bezos is obviously a genius. He says, you know, if it's not an experiment, if you know how it's going to turn out, right? I mean, maybe Cosmo closes tomorrow, right? Maybe not, right? Maybe it is a rocket ship. You know, we're just playing patty cake right now and seeing what we can learn.
Yeah, I love the experimental kind of ethos that you're applying. And I guess would love to kind of, I know you sound very optimistic on a lot of the other players and their unique approaches. Obviously, there's a ton of money going into space. GoPuff's got billions behind it. What are your predictions on a lot of those services? Obviously, a lot of them are calling themselves grocers. But like, as you mentioned, they are stocking something that's more like a bodega selection. You know, how well can those unit economics work and where are they going to work best?
You know, the most interesting thing that comes to my mind in response to your question revolves around tip leverage, right? And so you didn't use these words, but there's a distinction in the market between the players because some of them use employees, right? Mm-hmm. People who, you know, are employees in a conventional sense, which is how we operate our business. And then others crowdsource their labor. And now crowdsourced labor is really tip leveraged labor, right? I'll give you $3 plus I'll pass on some or all of the tip to you. Or I'll give you, if there's no tip, I'll give you $5. If there is a tip, I'll give you $3. So we're going to leverage the tip to drive down the cost of the delivery. And I think that piece of the puzzle is the most interesting thing to think about with these different models. Like, you know, to the extent you can offer a basket of groceries, you know, a big one, a little one, or medium size, doesn't really matter. And you can fix your cost to fulfill that order at $3, right? It's going to cost me $3 to deliver that because I'm going to give you the tip that the customer, the pre-tip. You know, when you combine that with a basket of gross profit, right, that's powerful. I mean, the economics of that are huge. Well, really, I'm talking about, you know, an operator who owns the marketplace for crowdsourced labor. Not if you're consuming crowdsourced labor, say you're going to buy a delivery from DoorDash, right? They're going to pay their driver $3 and they're going to charge you $12, right? The difference is their margin, right? And so if you're consuming crowdsourced labor in that regard, this, you know, that's not going to work. But to the extent you own the crowdsourced labor marketplace that you're using, and you combine that with products you own, and you get a margin on, that is very interesting from a business perspective.
I would love to dive into some of these audience submitted questions. First question is, you know, what percentage of revenue is prepared food, and what have you learned about prepared food on impact on customer order frequency?
Prepared food is important. It's we call it an order initiator. The truth about prepared food is that you eat it 3 or 4 times a day, right? Breakfast, lunch, dinner, maybe you get a coffee at 2 o'clock, right? That's a lot of occasions for you to go to the store or get a delivery. You know, groceries you need once or twice a week. And so it does create frequency because on a daily basis, you're looking for that 3 or 4 times a day. So we do operate a deli in each of our yummy.com stores. You know, it's an important part of the equation.
We got Albert here asking, how much harder is it to offer the full fresh offering of a grocer versus the convenience model of some of these newer players? And what are the differentiated SKUs that most quick commerce players don't have? For example, meat or bakery or other fresh prepared items?
You know, to the extent I've looked at the other quick commerce players, I think many of them have a pretty good assortment. I think the marketing or the way the customers interact with the assortment may be different than the way they interact with us. You know, to the extent there's less friction in the relationship, the customer will order more or less. You know, I can't really speak to the other players, but people want more assortment. You know, Amazon kind of taught you that you need lots of assortment. More assortment is better. But that's not the end game, right? To build a basket or to get somebody to choose you to procure $50, $75, $100 worth of groceries is much more than just offering the assortment, right? You put ground beef on the shelf at 7-Eleven. Is anybody going to buy it? You know, I don't know if it really matters that it's on the shelf. There's more to it. There's the magic, the alchemy of a brand, and the customer relationship is more than just putting products on a shelf.
We have another reader asking, how much does assortment vary location to location? And in terms of inventory costs, how much do you benefit from location-specific assortment optimization?
It's very similar across the stores. In certain communities like Silver Lake, you know, there is more vegan product. But our general assortment has always been analogous to Costco, in that Costco offers an aspirational assortment, right? A limited assortment of aspirational grocery products. So, like, I'm not even sure that at Costco you can buy conventional chicken, you know, chicken with hormones and antibiotics. I know at Yummy you can't, right? We don't sell, you know, hormone and antibiotic, you know, filled chicken. And so we've always tried to provide a limited aspirational assortment. And that's probably partly a reflection of the communities we serve. But in the Valley, for example, I think we have a little bit more conventional focus. Customers are a little more price sensitive. So you have to reflect the community no matter what.
We have another member asking, what is the deepest pain point for you at the moment for improving customer experience?
You know, I think the labor cost is the biggest challenge, because if we could access lower cost deliveries, then our service would improve. You know, you could staff more. As it exists today, you know, the cost of providing the service, the labor component that is necessary to deliver in about 30 minutes is a challenge, right? And there's no doubt that the cost to provide the service, the labor component, is the biggest barrier to offering good service and a competitive advantage. So to the extent we can solve for that, you know, lower our costs, like if we chose to offer a crowdsourced labor model and we owned the marketplace for it, you know, that would perhaps allow us to offer even better service because we have scale in the market and, you know, the deliveries could be accomplished quicker.
But do you think, are there any advantages you think now, given the legislative, the action going around Prop 22 being called unconstitutional, does that give you kind of a leg up now that that's kind of up in the air?
You know, I don't know what to say about it. You know, I respect our employees and I'm happy to have them. There's something weird about the outsourced labor, right? You know, you come up, we're so good at labels, right? Let's call it crowdsourced instead of outsourced, and therefore it's something new. If we add a software layer to a crowdsourced, outsourced labor model, the software labor somehow makes it legal, right? I don't know. It's very confusing, right? There is something weird about being able to craft a law to create a protected economic activity with the power of, you know, money. I don't know what to say about it. I mean, you know, if that is the law, right? If society says that's the way we want to do it, you know, we all have to accept that and, you know, go with the flow or, you know, swim against the tide.
If society says that gig economy is something we want, or if they're against it?
Well, no, if that's what society wants, right? That, you know, we voted in California for Prop 22, right?
And, yeah, so we're for it.
You know, it, to the extent that it is determined to be legal, right? I mean, what do you say? But that is the way we do it here. I mean, that is a reflection of society. We like it this way. This is the way we want relationships to exist. Yeah. So, you know, I'm not judging it. I'm just saying, right. You know, it's interesting. It's something weird. It's, you know, that is an innovation, right? To go to market with this idea that we're going to, you know, create a whole new labor classification. That's, you know, that's one for the ages. That's truly a remarkable accomplishment.
I don't know if consumers would know what it would really be like if all of a sudden tomorrow, Instacart, DoorDash, et cetera, Uber Eats, all decided that everyone was going to be a full-time employee. And I don't know if they would know what that experience would ultimately end up costing them as far as the wait times and the fees and all that. So
it'd be more expensive, right?
Everything would. Yeah. I don't think they'd be able to get it at a price and a level of convenience that they're used to.
Well, like we, for example, we're fully owned labor. We provide the vehicles, we pay the gas, the insurance, people get a wage. We comply with all the work rules. You know, we're an example of the quality of service you could get and the price you would pay, right? Because that's what we do today. We don't utilize any of those new work rules. And, but that margin opportunity that a crowdsourced labor market has would go away, right? Where they can leverage the tip, you know, you tip $7, you know, that is meaningful to a crowdsourced labor provider because they can reduce the cost they're going to pay the driver.
Yeah. Do you do anything with regards to kind of like the behavioral psychology around tipping to make that better for on your economics?
Nothing to do with my economics. You know, it's all for the driver. You know, their drivers are grateful for it. And, you know, during COVID, that was such a hard time. You know, to be honest, that was a really uncertain time, right? If you were in the delivery business or the service business and you were personally providing the service. So say you were a driver, you were incredibly brave, right? You were going to deliver nourishing food to a stranger in an unknown place, right? You don't know what you're going to encounter when you make a delivery. You don't know if that person has COVID. You don't know if in the elevator you're going to get it. You don't know anything, right?
Totally.
And so, but you do the job, right? And you did the job. And the expression of gratitude by our customer base in the form of tips was, you know, greatly appreciated and, you know, well-deserved. I mean, it's a two-way street. But tips have nothing to do with me. It's all between the driver and the customer.
Yeah, makes sense. I guess, like, you know, having been on the other side of this for DoorDash and Instacart, it does. If you're able to kind of know what the driver is going to make in the form of tip, you can kind of pass that along. You can make some of your other fees lower. It's all like psychology of what the customer's at the end of the day paying, right? You know, they're going to charge a higher service fee, but then the customer doesn't tip. Ultimately, that driver has to get paid some minimum, right? There has to be some floor.
Yeah, that's my point about the crowdsourced labor innovation, is that the employer can leverage the tip. It's like if you go into a restaurant and if you told them when you were being seated how much you were going to tip, they would then go to the waitress or waiter and say, I'll give you $2 to service that table because I have this tip waiting for you.
Yep.
Right. And it's just a different way to skin the cat, you know. But to leverage the tip is a new way of a business managing its own economics, when you can actually look at the tip in advance and say, I'm going to turn my dials in relation to my employees because I can leverage that tip. That's new.
Well, this has been really illuminating, really fascinating to hear it from an expert like yourself. So thank you so much for coming on board. If Angelinos want to, you know, use Cosmo or Yummy, how can they go and get started? And this is your time to plug away.
Yeah, plug away. Order at yummy.com, YUMMY.com, or Cosmo, KOZMO.com. Happy to help you.
Thank you so much. And we will be in touch.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you hear, please hit subscribe wherever you're listening to this podcast. And if you're curious to get a firsthand look at the cutting edge of food and tech, check out hungry.tv. That's Hungry with No U, where you can join in on live conversations like these or sign up for the free weekly newsletter.